Accession number 20459, reel 20.
Captain Spencer, reel 20. What sort of naval force did you normally have in Borneo, and what was their role?
Well, the Borneo, which was a British protectorate, virtually never had an armed force of any consequence at all. Police were armed, but again, they were very limited in number. We had a small contingent of engineers, but otherwise, most personnel visiting here were various naval ships. It was the British North Borneo Company, you probably know, and it was, I think, the first, it was Sir James Brooke who first took possession or got concessions in about 1881, and then when we went in, there was Sir Vina Brooke, his son or grandson, was the prominent party, but because it was a big British protectorate, Vina Brooke and his family were a little unpopular, and they were trying to resist. So we used to get a lot of message from the government and to and fro about where Vina—he wasn't in the territory, but you know, protection and where he might come and what should we do of so and so. One of the particular jobs I had was to decode the messages from the governor. And once or twice, I would decode the message, and then it said, from here, for the governor's attention only. So I used to take this to And he said, well, you know, will you decode it? I said, I can't, it says so. I can't decode it. He said, oh, come on, Tony. I said, no. He said, oh, come on, Tony, for heaven's sake, will you do it? So I said, all right. So I would then decode the messages for him.
What sort of code were they using?
Well, it was a... I really can't tell you, give it a name, but it was a book code, which used to be changed from time... Well, I think once when I was there. So it was just purely... a book code, so you looked up the particular things and then decoded it. Nothing complicated at all. So that was one of the things. But it might be interesting. I don't know what the facts are, but in Borneo at this time were quite a number of the officers who had been interned during the war. But were there, and they had been told by the British government that, with great regret, there was no possibility of finding any defence of the island at all, and therefore they should not. Those that could get away should do, and those that remain must not offer any resistance. So it would appear that this was quite an anxious time. And as I was led to believe by people there, a force of some 36 Japanese under one officer were landed down the coast. I think it was a place called Beaufort. It was the end of the railway line, or it was called Malipo there, I think, or something. By this time, the bridges had been temporarily repaired. Not a particularly good structure, but the train could run over it. Or one of the lighters was an old, not a full engine at all, but a sort of rather small unit. And the Japanese walked up the hill to the railway station. And the station master was there. And so should have been the 4 o'clock train. And the Japanese officer who spoke fluent English said, "Where is the train?" So the station master said, "We heard that it was going to be an invasion, so it's still at Jessalyn." "Well, get the bloody thing up here," he said. So the train was duly sent to Beaufort, and the 36th Japanese got on it and took it into to where they took the final, took the surrender. I think, I'm not quite sure that the governor was there, but this was the invasion of what's name, and people were interned there. A little later, of course, quite a considerable number of Japanese did turn up, and I think that the conditions in the camp were reasonable, although I met a number, particularly the doctors, several of them were quite severely beaten up, but there wasn't the same atrocities there in other parts. But I thought that the invasion of the place was quite interesting.
Were there any Japanese left in the territory when you arrived there?
None at all.
What had happened to them? Have they been sent
back to
Japan?
They've been transferred away completely.
What you mentioned, you had Royal Engineers there. What were they doing? What was
their
main role?
Well, they were repairing the railway, the bridges, basically. That was their main job. Otherwise, there was no other structural damage as far as the place. Mm. They were improving the road. They were doing sort of ordinary building work. So it was generally a maintenance role at this particular time. But that was sort of later on.
And the Navy, you said they, you know, the largest presence there, service presence, was naval. Did they have extensive base facilities?
No, virtually none. There was no naval personnel stationed on the island at all, to my knowledge, at all. They were just, the ships would come in. There was the dockyard staff. They would always anchor off. There was no dock. I mean, there was a number of small jetties, but no dock that the boats could to go to. But it was the tradition, you know, to go for various, what's the name, sort of, you know, visits of so-and-so. There was no uprisings or, obviously the criminal courts were busy with minor crimes.
You said the police were armed. What sort of numbers are we talking about in terms of the police?
I should say that over the... I went to Jesselton and Jackson, but in Jesselton itself... So Deccan was originally the capital. Mm. Jesselton was now. I would say there was no more than... spread over that part of the coast, probably no more than 25, or 25, 30 possibly.
Were they locally recruited, or were they...
They were all under British... There were two British officers... and yes, from local. There was a Sikh there who may have, may not been there. The inhabitants were mostly, there were the Dusans and the Dayaks and Bugis, I think they were called, and Chinese, and a limited number of Indians. So that again, the Sikh may have been of an Indian family there.
And you were saying that there was no real threat to internal security, that it was.
No, none at all. There were no, I was probably one of the few people who used to travel inland a little, and that probably leads me to another, at one particular time. We had three people, visitors coming to the island, who were, to my surprise, were members of different petroleum companies. And I had previously, you know, gone into various parts of the jungle, and I'd taken visitors to Kinabalu with guides and horses and that sort of thing. So I can't understand how those army personnel got lost, because, you know, the proper guide there, it was quite a climb, but not that difficult. So I was appointed. Their mission was to trace the markings left by a previous petroleum survey of Borneo. I think they did some seismic testings of various things, and he was supposed to have put some concrete markings in at various places. They had the map references. These, of course, were totally overgrown and everything else. And so I agreed to, well, I not agreed, I was told to take these pierced rails to try and trace these particular spots, which they wanted to verify. It meant that we had a number of porters, and I insisted that at least one crate of scotch should be included in the party. And so we set off. Now, we had a sort of rather like a curricle type boat, because, you know, by that time the bridges hadn't been built. And so we'd get we'd jeep up to a river, and then we'd take the curricle across, and then so and so. But we were going to the furthest location so far, which meant going down. I mean, some of the rivers are reasonably negotiable, others were particularly. So it really quite a journey into the semi-interior of the place. And so, you know, we had quite a number of porters and people that hacked their way through the jungle and coming across various long houses and people. Quite a number of these were headhunters in the old days, and they used to proudly show us the shrunken heads hanging from their belt, which include one or two Japanese, I understand, as well. And since I then spoke fairly reasonable Malay and used to do wrestling with some of the people, it was really quite an interesting trip, but plagued by mosquitoes. But, for instance, I mean, we would shoot a wild chicken, which is called, I can't remember what the name in Malaya was, and the natives used to prepare it by feathers and all, flinging it into the embers of a fire, baked in clay, the real traditional way. And I must say, it was absolutely fantastic. These three people, I can't remember their names now, but we became, obviously, in these sort of circumstances, very good friends. And it transpired that this previous expedition was done in 1934. And they had every evidence that there was oil in quite considerable quantities there. So later, it rather amazed me that it took another 25 years to discover it was there. But they did explain that through the world, there was absolutely, I won't say unlimited supplies of oil, but they knew about the oil in the North Sea.
Question of accessibility, isn't it?
Question of accessibility. And they said until, there's no point in opening up other places with the transport difficulties or anything, when there's more than adequate. Things have changed there, but there's two things that, as I mentioned before, surprised me. One is that three separate oil companies, I don't know how they're interrelated, were interested in it. And two, that oil and coal was, I think they had discovered coal, but not such in vast quantities. So that was a particularly interesting trip.
You said that the headhunters, had they given up headhunting entirely?
I came across a person who, in actual fact, I saw in prison, who had not headhunted, but had killed somebody who had been with his wife. And I do particularly remember that both the tribe and the person concerned couldn't understand why he was being held in prison. Because he did what he should have done, and, you know, and nobody would do it. I actually don't know how this eventually resolved, but, I mean, I did have sympathy with him anyway. And because the people were saying, well, you know, there's no crime at all.
He'd done the right thing according to them.
So I think that again, it was such a vast... The penetration into there were no roads into the interior. It's still quite a large, I imagine... a largely unexplored territory, or it certainly was then.
What about going over it by air? Did you have an Air Force presence at all?
No, there was no Air Force.
No airport.
No airport on Borneo.
No landing facilities.
No landing facilities at all. Mm. Not even as far as I know, we can't, well, I mean, obviously a helicopter from a plane could. That is not true. They, coming round to that, at Labourn Island, which is off the coast, which is quite a sea journey away from, there was a landing field. And this is also very interesting because it was within the territory that I had to expect. So I used to take the motor, I can't remember what we called it before, but the motor launch over to Labourn. And at that particular time, there was a sergeant, a corporal, and two blokes, army personnel, who were looking after the landing strip. And there was a cargo boat there, and the Americans, or mostly Americans, were flying in these various planes, mostly flying fortresses, which were to be broken up and loaded on the cargo boat and going to be dumped at sea. But obviously the sergeant thought this was a rather bit of a waste of material. And the second time I went there, he'd built himself some fairly luxurious apartments. He'd got silver candelabras on his table, and he entertained me most lavishly. So I thought, well, something must be happening. And the upshot of it, as far as I understand, he was selling some of these planes whole.
To whom?
Buyers from the area. I mean, I have no evidence of this, but it seemed pretty obvious to this. But otherwise, of course, he was doing a great part service to various people running these things. The next time I visited, he had been promoted to a lieutenant, but he was even more affluent. And so I said, "I'm sorry, but I mean, there's every evidence that." That what you should be doing is not doing. I'm sorry, but I'll have to write a report. You know, I can pay you. I said, no, I'm sorry.
Well, he was offering to pay you off.
Well, he didn't actually. More, yes, he did in so many words. Well, you know, you don't want to do that. I mean, there's money to be made here, and you know, you can obviously share in it. You know. I don't know why I didn't take the offer, but still, I said, I'm sorry, but John, but I've got to report it. You see. Yeah, well, there we are. He said, I'm probably all right already. So.
Do you know what regiment he was from or what corps?
I think he was RE's again.
Royal Engineer.
Yeah, Royal Engineers. I think is why he had the job. Because he had, I think they had a squad of people to do the air, you know, to extend the landing so the planes could land there anyway. So, and then he was just left to do it. And there were a number of workers who were, in theory, were breaking up the aircraft. So I duly put the report to so-and-so that I said, I have no evidence, but it would appear that from the style and so forth and so on and so on. So he said, I'll tell you, somebody wouldn't do something like that. I said, well, it looks as if that is, you know, I think we should perhaps take some action about it. Oh, no, I don't think so. Well, if we hear, if anybody makes a complaint, you know, we'll maybe do something about it. I thought, well, I don't know whether I should really press the matter or not. I did to a certain extent, but it's he's the governor.
His decision.
I've got it in writing. I've got him to sign my report. So that if anything did come, I had evidence that it had been reported. The other feature of this, of course, that I was the commodore of the governor's yacht. And he hated the water, really. So come the weekends, I used to suggest a party. There were only 8 white women in the area. So they automatically had an invitation to come on the boat at the weekend. But the other people had to sort of negotiate with me as to who else should come. So I think I've shown some photographs here of the boats where, and they were, I mean, some of the islands there, they had the beaches which went down like that. You could take the boat right up to the beach.
Yes.
And other times you obviously moor just a little way away. That's Lebourne Island, by the way, and that's one of the pictures of the boat was
yes.
Lebourne Island. Mm. Anyway, so that this was quite a good. The other feature is that I showed you a picture of the boat with the outrigger, but the thing that really absolutely was quite astounding was the coral in that area, the floor, the coral forest. We hadn't really any snorkeling equipment, but, you know, by placing a bit of perspex or glass on the water, you get a thing. So I came up with the idea that we cut a hole in one of these canoes and set a bit of glass in, which had a most dramatic effect. Mm. If I'd started a business then, I could have made a fortune, because people used to fight to come out, and it was only, you know, room
on
for
your little canoe.
Yeah, mm. on my little canoe, mm. with this perspex, mm. what's the name, and you had a most fantastic, I can't believe the colours, mm. and the fish and everything else that there. So it was an idyllic place. I had a little bungalow on the beach with three fridges in it, full of drink, which is quite essential. My dog and my jeep used to tour the area, and we became quite well known. I think I showed you a picture of all the people on the mm. on yes. the jeep. And also that they had a cross between a mule and a horse. I can't remember what they call the animal now. But I used to do quite a lot of riding in the area, and this dog used to come with me, and when he got very tired I used to pat the saddle and it would leap up and I'd catch it by the neck and sit it on the saddle. So it used to sit in the front of this jeep, and it also, so wherever we travelled we normally were well greeted. Mm. And the Malays are particularly friendly. The obviously, again, because of the position I held, I had quite a lot of invitations all over the place. I was not, had to be careful as far as with the local population is concerned, because it might be felt that you know, were favouring them in some particular way, which I found very typical in Malaya. But I do certainly remember one quite prominent Chinese businessman and politician insisted that I came to his house for a dinner. Knowing how well they entertained, I'd arranged for a litter to come back at about midnight, mm. just in case, because you had to walk along this very narrow wooden platform with planks missing and everything else. And I can imagine myself very easily slipping off this on the way back. And the dinner was typical of the entertainment you got by the people there, is that the women of the family never sat at the table. All the males sat round the table, and the women waited on you and knelt beside your chair and washed your hands and towels and bought all the food. And I said, well, you know what, he said, well, you know, and he said, well, if there's anything left over, they can have that. Well, no. But one of the great problems of being entertained with the Cham is they have a tradition which is called Yam Sing. I don't know whether you've ever heard that. But the tradition is that each member of the people there wish to drink a toast with the principal visitor. So they fill your glass and they say Yam Sing, and you've got to knock it back. Well, the more people are there, the drunker you're going to get. And even though I think in those days I really hard head, and was the job itself needed me to be fairly well practiced. But on this particular occasion, I remember that I was glassy eyes, and then we came to the great treat of the evening, which was 100 years old in theory, Chinese egg. Well, that particular time, feeling as I was, the thought of this, and when this egg, single egg, in its, you know, without its shell, came in all black, I was feeling definitely very queasy, but the way they dissected it into the thinnest of slices, and was busting. In actual fact, it tasted quite, you know, so concentrated egg, it wasn't true, or nothing at all about it. But I do, I just remember, I think, having the sedan chair or litter being, coming to the door and taking me away. There's no way that I could have driven in the Jeep. And luckily, some people in the club there, so I managed to get in there, and they said, "No, right, we'll get you home." But the one or two occasions like that, but you had to watch it very carefully.
What sort of activity were the Chinese engaged in? Were they trading as their main activity at that time?
Again, there was quite a lot of the export trade. They produced dyes. And there was pepper, spices, and quite a lot of pepper in there. So there were quite a lot of spices being produced for the area. Compared with Milano, there was also rubber in the area. There was also silver. I never quite know where they discovered it, but also there were one or two other minerals there. So it's mostly teak. The forests were teak, so there's quite a big lumber business. That was slightly further down the coast.
This time, I think there was quite a lot of turbulence going on in Indonesia, which is the next door neighbour. Did that generate any sort of anxiety?
Well, really, Sarawak and Brunei, and Sarawak and Borneo, or British North Borneo, were all part of the British protectorate.
Yes.
So you were really quite a long way from that. We had troubles in Malaya.
Yes.
And I had no reports of, I mean, the Sultan of Brunei was there. He hadn't got his oil then, of course. There were very little indication of any particular troubles in that particular part of the area. One other thing that I used to do a lot of shooting in Malaya, and not so much in Borneo, because I was fairly busy, but I used to go crocodile shooting, and one of the things where my bungalow was, the crocodiles will come right up to almost to the estuary of so-and-so. And I can't remember who he was now, but he was somebody from Singapore came over, and somebody mentioned about crocodile shooting. He particularly wanted to go out and shoot a crocodile. I had no special gun. I had a 303 which I doctored the bullets a bit so that they came through. And there's only one vital spot. You either got to shoot down its throat, or you've got to penetrate between the eyes virtually. And I'd only done it a couple of times, but it was mentioned. So the two of us went out in one of these narrow canoes, and I was in front, paddling, and he was at the back. And on the bank, some 50, 60 yards away, was this fairly large crocodile. So I said, "Well, you know, if you like, but, you know, take very careful aim, and what's the aim, and then be ready to paddle like mad if necessary." Anyway, what I didn't know is that he stood up in the boat. Mm. And he'd really never found the gun. So when he found the gun, of course, it knocked him over backwards into the water, dropping the rifle as well.
Into the water?
Into the water. He dropped the rifle into the water.
And then fell in.
And then he